had a policy before the Gulf War of building up Saddam Hussein as a counterweight to Iran. That was a mistake.
If your objective is to, you know, overthrow Saddam Hussein, the United States of America cannot be stopped. But it is not our job to determine who rules Iraq.
This doesn't mean Iraq has these weapons. It means that we can't confirm Iraq's story. This is...
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, December 19th, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. United Nations Weapons Inspection Chief Hans Blix reported back to the UN Security Council today on his team's evaluation of Iraq's 12,000-page weapons report. Speaking this morning in a closed-door session, Blix said that more inspections are needed before Iraq can be given a clean bill of health. Blix briefed reporters in New York after the session.
As to the assessment of the declaration, we are consistent in the view that there has been relatively little given in the declaration by way of evidence concerning the programs of weapons of mass destruction. There has been material concerning the period between 1998 and 2002 in the non-nuclear weapons field. And we will evidently continue the analysis. The Council is clear that it wants us to come back sometime in January for a more profound, thorough briefing than we've been able to do so far.
Hans Blix, Chief UN Weapons Inspector in Iraq. Among the Security Council members at this morning's meeting, Syria was conspicuously absent after walking out in protest of the Council's decision to release the full text to only the five permanent members of the Council. Ambassador Mikhail Awebe expressed his disappointment to reporters at the UN, asserting that it is impossible for Syria to fully assess whether Iraq has complied with the provisions of UN resolution because pertinent portions of the report have been excised.
The E10 countries did not receive the full text of the declaration, and that sticks to our principle from the beginning because we believe that procedure is against the and in flagrant contradiction and violation to 1441 resolution. If we are unable to get the full text of the declaration, on which basis we can discuss the reports even of Mr. Blix and Mr. Baradei and the other interventions of the members of the Council. Syria is very much concerned with the discussion because it's, first of all, an Arabic country. Second, it's very close and the closest to Iraq. We have a very long border. Geographically, is very important. If anything happened to Iraq, obviously would affect Syria and all the area in the Middle East. That's what we are keen not to happen, and from here stemmed our concerns. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. You're not taking part in the conclusions of these discussions.
We are not.
Does that mean that you left your hand up and saying that the conclusion is for well known now and that you there's no
how,
really...
I said how to be party into the conclusions and to the discussion as far as we don't have the full text and we don't know what is in. The most sensitive paragraphs excised from the report. So we have no access to the report, on which basis we can be party to the conclusions in that case.
Syrian ambassador to the UN, Mikhail Webby, today at the UN. The U.S. ambassador to the UN, John Negroponte, accused Iraq of deliberately misleading the UN Security Council, asserting that the December 7th report contains reams and reams of material that was submitted previously. Negroponte goes on to claim that any omissions to the report are not the result of error, but an attempt on the part of a rogue nation to deceive the Security Council.
Today, the Security Council met in informal consultations to discuss the Iraqi December 7th declaration. We informed the Council that we were deeply disappointed that Iraq has again defied the Council's demands and chosen deception and concealment over full disclosure. The December 7th declaration clearly shows that Iraq has spurned its last opportunity to comply with its disarmament obligations, padded with reams of extraneous material. The declaration fails to address scores of questions pending since 1998. It seeks to deceive when it says that Iraq has no ongoing weapons of mass destruction programs. It also fails completely to comply with the provisions of operative paragraph number 3 of Resolution 1441. It is truly unfortunate that Iraq has begun what was supposed to be a new chapter in compliance with Council resolutions by falling back on the regime's practice of omissions, evasions, and untruths. It should be obvious that this pattern of systematic holes and gaps in Iraq's declaration is not the result of accidents, editing oversights, or technical mistakes. These are material omissions that in our view constitute another material breach. It is up to Iraq to prove that there is some other explanation besides the obvious one, that this declaration is just one more act of deception in a history of lies from a defiant dictator. In the days ahead, we intend to continue our analysis of this declaration. We will be consulting with friends, allies, and other members of the Council, and we will support the efforts of UNMOVIC and IAEA as they carry forward with their work. Meanwhile, I must emphasize our view that Iraq's December 7th declaration has done nothing to dispel the serious doubts that we have about the regime's veracity and gives us no confidence that Iraq intends to comply with its disarmament obligations.
U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. John Negroponte, a senior Iraqi official speaking in Baghdad, said Iraq has nothing to fear because Iraq has nothing to hide.
As I said, we're not worried because there's nothing that they can pin on us. All their statements were mere allegations, not supported by evidence. Whatever evidence they dared to submit was checked out. Both agencies, their inspectors here on the ground, they went around the country from north to everywhere looking at the sites that were named in those allegations. I will not preempt their findings. They have been checking everything, records. They've been taking samples, taking measurements, and some of these analyses would take some time. So I'll not preempt and say they found nothing. It's for them. In due time, they will say whatever the truth is.
From Baghdad, a senior Iraqi official. In an interview on MSNBC, former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter provided analysis of Iraq's December 7th weapons report to the UN. In contrast to other pundits, Ritter challenged the assertion that Iraq should be considered guilty until proven innocent.
Listing the totality of its weapons programs, the scientists, the materiel, and an accounting. What's at issue here is that there are many of those, and I happen to fall into this camp, that believe that the accounting is insufficient, that Iraq hasn't provided, you know, a body of data that verifies and confirms, you know, what it says is the final disposition.
Yeah, that's my point.
This doesn't mean that...
That's my point, though, isn't it?
But this doesn't mean that Iraq... This doesn't mean Iraq has these weapons. It means that we can't confirm Iraq's story. This is like a criminal suspect coming up with an alibi. You don't convict because the alibi isn't convincing. You have to do an investigation and show with substantive fact that the alibi is a lie, that he has, in fact, committed a crime.
Maybe you can help us with this because you're certainly an expert on this. As I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, people like yourselves were already there in the 1990s and you confirmed that these weapons were there. So now we ask them, what did you do with the weapons? And they say, what weapons? Doesn't that seem a little crazy?
First of all, we never confirmed that these weapons were there. What we did is had the Iraq, we did an accounting, and we came up with holes in the Iraqi accounting. We said, hey, how about these 155 millimeter artillery shells with mustard agent? And the Iraqis went, these were in weapons depots that you bombed during the Gulf War, and we don't know what happened to them. They got blown hither thither. And we said, you need to confirm this. You need to account for it. And they couldn't. It doesn't mean that these weapons existed. In fact, what I'll tell you is that we have no evidence that any of these weapons existed in 1998. You will never find a single United Nations document that says these weapons existed. What the United Nations documents say and what our inspections confirmed is that we cannot substantiate Iraqi allegations that these weapons have in fact been destroyed. We don't know what the final disposition is. That's the situation that existed in 1998. That's the situation that exists today.
Former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter during an interview on MSNBC. The former chief of mission to Iraq, Edward Peck, is critical of the Bush administration's seeming agenda to launch an attack against Iraq. During a conversation with Peace Watch yesterday, Peck said Americans need to raise their voices if they oppose the impending war.
I think that those people who are concerned about the war and opposed to the likely negative impact of a war certainly owe it to the president to make sure that he knows what they think. And you got to speak out.
Let me ask you this, Ambassador. The military attack plan discussed in that article in the Washington Post calls for armored units charging into Iraq across land until they meet opposition forces. And there's talk of having a tactical surprise striking before the U.S. military appears to be prepared to do so. Where is the U.N. process in that strategy?
Well, it isn't, as a matter of fact. One of the things that has been interesting, if you watch that part of the world, is that the countries out there, none of which, even if they're sharing borders with Iraq, evidently perceive Iraq as the kind of threat that we make it out to be. They've always said that they will not let us put our troops through there. And so I wonder very seriously how you get, A, the surprise, and B, the heavy forces moving through. In March of this year, I took part in a war game in Europe, which was examining that question. I was the political advisor to a four-star general. And it was fairly obvious that in order to do what needs to be done, you have to put massive major forces through Kuwait. And the Kuwaitis have said no, not because they don't fear Saddam Hussein, but because they fear vastly more what's going to happen if the United States of America goes in and attempts to overthrow that regime. And that's where the Saudis are and the Egyptians and the Syrians and even the Iranians, who had an eight-year war with Iraq, have said, don't do this. Do not do this, because they understand far better than the hawks, if you can call them that, in the Pentagon, what is likely to be entailed if you try.
And yet, many of these countries signed on to the UN resolution, I guess, supporting the process.
Supporting the process, yes, indeed, because of a belief that by so doing, they could either, A, forestall the inevitable horror, or at a minimum, at a maximum, rather, find that actually there's no basis for doing it. It is hard for me. I'm not a UN expert. It is very difficult for me to envision a situation in which the United Nations Security Council passes something that authorizes the invasion and of Iraq and the overthrow of the government. That is not something they're going to do, which is why the countries that we would rely on, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, have said that when the UN passes such a resolution, we will consider, what role we should play. And I think they're doing that secure in the knowledge that it will never pass, because there are too many countries there that will say no, no, no. Not because they like Saddam Hussein, but because they fear far worse the impact on the entire region of a United States armed invasion of and overthrow of an Arab regime.
Did you ever meet Mr. Hussein?
I never did. He was not terribly open to or accessible to representatives from governments like the United States in those days. In fact, my successor never met him either, and my successor's successor was April Glaspie, and she really only met him that one time.
Mm-hmm. that one very crucial time?
Not crucial, really. Saddam Hussein knew in his heart that he was doing the right thing. April Glaspie, if she had had instructions, and she didn't, to threaten him with an armed attack, would have done so. She had no such instructions, so she's not going to commit U.S. forces without being allowed, without being told to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And people have asked me, could our ambassador in Iraq have stopped Saddam Hussein? And I said, yes, indeed, if she'd shot him four times. Short of that, he was going to do what he thought was the right thing. Could an ambassador from Saudi Arabia talk George Bush out of invading Iraq right now? I don't think so, because as of this moment, he knows it's the right thing to do.
The quote-unquote right thing.
Well,
to
you
do.
Know, this is, it's all perception.
Now, but then that sort of suggests that any dialogue between the two of them would never happen then.
Well, it, you know, it depends on what it is you want, and from that perspective, you're right. If your objective is to, you know, overthrow Saddam Hussein, and by the way, it's worthwhile noting in passing that that is not a mandate that anybody has given us. The United States of America cannot be stopped, but it is not our job to determine who rules Iraq, an Arab country, Christian and Muslim, you know, 7,000 miles from where I'm sitting. That's not our job, folks. A lot of people are going to resent it when you do that.
But to say that Bush and Saddam should talk, but then you just revealed a side of Saddam where he's not really been open or accessible to any kind of dialogue
for
decades.
No, he has. No, that was then when I was stationed there. You know, Tony Snow just spoke with Tariq Aziz, and mm-hmm. Tony Snow, of one of the networks, you know, is a knowledgeable, intelligent man. If you wanted to send over somebody at the appropriate level, Saddam Hussein has indicated many times that he would like to open a dialogue. But, see, it doesn't have to be with him. It can be with Tariq Aziz if you send somebody over in a position to represent the United States and discuss these things. I mean, that's what diplomats do for a living,
mm-hmm.
bless us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I remember very clearly, perhaps you do as well, that after the invasion of Kuwait, President Bush, the elder, said on several occasions that he was sending James Baker, the Secretary of State, over to meet with Saddam Hussein. And the message came back, and it said Secretary Baker is more than welcome, and he can meet with Tariq Aziz, the Deputy Prime Minister, Minister of Foreign Affairs. And they said, no, he meets with Saddam Hussein. And the word came back, and it said, look, you come, I talk to you. You send your guy, he talks to my guy.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that how it works? So yeah. Baker never went because, by George, he wasn't going to talk to anybody less than the head guy, but Baker was not the head guy here.
Mm-hmm.
This comes across as just a touch, let's use the word openly, just a touch arrogant.
Former Chief of Missions to Iraq, Edward Peck. Yesterday on Peace Watch, we spoke with Andreas Zumach, a reporter for the German daily Die Tage Zeitung, who obtained an unedited copy of Iraq's weapons declaration. The declaration contained a list of U.S. and German corporations that have supplied Iraq with weapons since 1998. Speaking with us this afternoon, Gary Milholland, director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control, said that while it is not illegal for countries to sell weapons to Iraq, it is, however, questionable. Mr. Milholland, we know that some 24 U.S. firms, it's been reported of late, have been named in the official documents from Iraq as having sold parts, computers, and possibly know-how to the Iraqis for the purpose of developing weapons of mass destruction. You've been tracking these firms for some time. Who are they, and did any of them sell only parts that had no other possible use but to develop weapons of mass destruction?
The things these firms sold were called dual-use items. That is, they were things that could be used to make weapons of mass destruction but also had civilian uses. In fact, when you're talking about machine tools or computers or materials, there are very few things that are used only for weapons of mass destruction. Almost everything, for example, in a nuclear weapon is made with dual-use equipment.
Mm. So the answer then is no.
No. Saddam Hussein was a good shopper. He bought his electronics from the United States. He bought his machine tools from the Swiss and the Germans. He bought other things where he could find them. just as anyone would who was looking for the best value for his money.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that a lot of those firms were American firms.
How many in your estimation?
The total number of U.S. firms that supplied Saddam Hussein with things that could be used to make weapons of mass destruction is probably more than the 20 or 24 that have been mentioned. We have data on many, many more than that. But these are the principal ones.
Well, who are some of those firms?
Firms like, for example, Unisys,
mm-hmm.
which is a large computer maker. It supplied an $8 or $9 million computer to the Iraqi Ministry of the Interior to track individual human beings. And so it's pretty clear that that computer was helping keep Saddam Hussein in power. And for all I know, it may still be helping him stay in power.
Mm-hmm. And some of the other companies?
Some of the companies that have been named are companies like Honeywell, Rockwell International, Tektronix, International Computer Systems, Sperry.
Mm-hmm. Well, as offensive as this information may be to many of our listeners, isn't this business as usual? Did they break any laws at the time?
Unfortunately, these companies did not break any laws. Almost all of this equipment was approved by the U.S. Commerce Department. That is, it actually received export licenses. We had a policy before the Gulf War of building up Saddam Hussein as a counterweight to Iran. That was a mistake. We thought that Saddam was a person we could do business with and that making him stronger fit into our overall geopolitical calculations. Now, that turned out to be a mistake. But the general idea was that by increasing trade with a regime like Iraq's, you could curry favor, you could build up your diplomatic weight in the Middle East, and at the same time, our companies made money.
Mm-hmm.
The sales were legal, but the companies must have known they were running a risk. They decided to take that risk in exchange for the export earnings. And many firms from other countries did the same. And now as we go back into Iraq 12 years later, if we do go in militarily, one of the objectives will be to destroy the very equipment that the West has provided.
Mm. You've been tracking these firms now for how many years?
I've been tracking exports into Iraq since about 1988 or 89. We were tracking components going in for the nuclear weapon program that was later discovered. We also were tracking missile components going in from various countries and the means to make chemical weapons as well.
Do you think these firms should be held accountable for their business practices?
Well, yes, these firms are being held accountable, at least in the court of public opinion, and they are very sensitive to being criticized. And yet, when it comes time to make decisions about whether you should sell something or not, many of them find it very difficult to resist a sale. There's no basis for going against these firms legally. But what we have to do is remember that if we're going to weaken our export control laws, which we have done, that one of the risks is that we're going to have to compensate for that weakness by seeing mass destruction weapon threats coming at us from places like Iraq. So what we're looking at here is really a lesson learned. We see that many of the problems that we're facing in Iraq were created by us. And what we have to do is make our export control laws stronger so we don't have to deal with such a problem again.
Mr. Milholland, are there any final thoughts on your part?
Well, one thing the administration is saying is that this latest declaration by the Iraqis, which includes the names of these companies, is incomplete. So I think what we have to look forward to is possibly more information coming out about other things that that the Iraqis have purchased in various places. They may be from the United States or they may be from other countries. But I think this is a story in which we have not yet seen the last chapter.
Gary Mulholland, former law professor and director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control.
Janica's marching home again. When Janica's marching home again. When Janica's marching home again, we'll all go out and welcome him. Never mind the shape he's in. Let's ask him how the fighting went. We'll ask him how the fighting went. We'll ask him how the fighting went and how he likes the president. Casualties are accident. And we'll beat our drums and wave our flags. We'll beat our drums and wave our flags. Beat our drums and wave our flags as great and grand and glorious rags. The ones they put in the body bags. And later on when the sickness comes. Later on when the sickness comes. Later on when the sickness comes from chemicals and uranium. We'll wring our hands and we'll all play dumb. Veterans who did their part. The veterans who did their part. See the veterans who did their part and came back home with a purple heart. Walking around with a shopping cart. See where are the legs he used to run? Where are the legs he used to run? Where are the legs he used to run before you went to carry a gun? I'm afraid your dancing days are done. You have no arm, you have no leg. You have no arm, you have no leg. You have no arm, you have no leg. You're an armless, legless, chickenless egg. They'll have to put you out with a bowl. Kill them and they'll kill us back. We'll kill them and they'll kill us back. We'll kill them and they'll kill us back. You see, it's always been like that. What a load of crap. So tip your hat and take a bow. Tip your hat and take a bow. Tip your hat and take a bow and get on with your life somehow. They're taking your little brother now.
Jim Page, When Johnny Comes Marching Home. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, hundreds of Muslim men are being called in and detained, and their families and friends take to the streets in protest. We'll be back in a moment. ¶¶